Verulam Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome again to Verulam Sport Podcasting. And where were you July the 14th, 2019? I bet, like most sports fans, you were enthralled by the sporting drama that was England versus New Zealand in the home one-day international World Cup final, in which England claimed the bacon. And we are very lucky indeed now to be joined by a man who took three wickets in that final, and also a man of the match performance in the semi-final win over the old enemy, Australia. It is Chris Wokes. How are you, Chris? Welcome to Verulam Sport Podcasting.
Thanks for having me on. It's been an interesting time, hasn't it, that we've been stuck in. But no, everything's well, thanks, mate. It's nice to be back out there playing some cricket, some training. You know, as we touched on off air, the old new normal is a bit different to what we're used to. But, you know, great to be back doing what we love to do, which is cricket. And hopefully, in the near future, we'll have some live cricket for everyone to see.
Yeah, absolutely. We're built towards that because the West Indies are in town, and it's always good when they come to town. They bring that Calypso flavour. It's going to be exciting. Of course, behind closed doors, very weird. But Chris, before we kind of delve into that and build up to that, first of all, I'm always fascinated by when I talk to world-class stars like yourself, about what actually inspired them. What got you into cricket? I know you started playing at a young age, seven, up at the Aston Manor Club in Birmingham Way. So what inspired you initially?
That's a good question, really. I don't know exactly what triggered me to become a cricketer, really, because I went and played cricket at the local club, Aston Manor, as you've said, because my brothers kind of play cricket. And I watched them play, and I thought I'd just give it a go. And you know, I'm lucky to a certain extent that you know when I did give cricket a go, I was half decent at it. And you know, that's probably one of the reasons why I stuck with it. You know, had that first experience of cricket being a bit different. You know, I might not be sat in this you know privileged position now. So yeah, it's a tricky one. And I think, you know, a lot of the time we look back on things, and in particular my situation there, I think a little bit of looking is involved in terms of the fact that, yeah, I watched and I played cricket because of my brothers. My older brothers played it. But my first experiences of playing cricket with friends was quite enjoyable because I was half decent. So, yeah, just a natural, really, I suppose, in that instance. But that's the main reason why I played. My brothers played it. And I watched them for a little while before I got into it, you know, properly.
I'm sure that similar story will be reflected by so many. But I've got to tell you, Chris, personally speaking, you're not wrong, I think, to observe that element of luck. But then you've got to seize it and maximise it. And I think that's credit to yourself because, you know, culminated with that wonderful ODI victory in front of the home fans. A cup winner, sir. So saluting you. Also, though, as a youngster, not bad, halfway decent footballer. I think you were in Walsall's academy. Was there ever any danger that England's cricket's loss could have been the beautiful game's gain?
Oh, well, I tell you what, I've asked this question a lot, you know, in terms of back in the day, and could I become a footballer and all that sort of business. And I suppose you never know. I think the real reason I kind of knocked football on the head was because my cricket was going in a better direction. I was certainly becoming a better cricketer than I thought I was becoming a footballer. And around the sort of age of 13, 14, when you know my cricket got a little bit more serious, I kind of made the decision to try and take that route on of trying to become a cricketer rather than pursuing the football stuff. And it wasn't because I fell out of love with football completely. I just felt that my cricket was developing at a good rate. You know, I was becoming better. I was playing against older players and felt like I could, you know, hold my own. Whereas when it came to football, I was kind of getting kicked around on the field and kind of bullied off the ball a lot of the time that age. And I just, you know, that was enough for me to decide that, you know, cricket was the way forward for me. So, you know, I'm obviously pleased that I decided to go down that route, because who knows where I'd be in the football world now, probably on the scrap heap somewhere.
Again, a good choice and a benefiting as all the sports fans and, of course, the England cricket fraternity too. Real quick question, Chris. Back in 2016, when you returned to the fold against Sri Lanka and played an absolute blinder, I was actually at Lord's that day providing a little bit of report for Verum Sports. And I quipped, who needs Stokes when we have Wokes? So just your memories of that particular encounter, because there was pressure and question marks over Chris Wokes as a test player.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm sure there's not many shouting, you know, that those comments now, having seen what Stokes has gone on to do. But yeah, I think, you know, that was a big turning point for me in terms of the international career, or my international career. I think that period of 2016, like you said, there was probably a few doubts whether I'd go on to play much more international cricket, in particular test cricket. And it was a big breakthrough year for me. I don't know what clicked. I just kind of had a few decent games running into my international selection, or return to the England team. And as you said, that Sri Lanka series went pretty well for me. I got a chance through Stokes's injury, really. Again, a little bit of luck, which goes your way, and got the opportunity to get back in the fold. And I did well. Whether it was a bit of a mindset thing, and because I knew it might be my last chance, I thought of maybe just thought, let's just run with it and give it my best shot, give it your all, and just see what happens. I don't know, but it certainly went well for me. And that summer, even probably to this day, is probably my best summer as an England player. You know, went on to win Test Player of the Year that year for England. So that was a big turning point for me in terms of my Test career, and kind of allowed me to realise that I could do it at that level, I suppose, particularly in the Test team, definitely.
Brilliant stuff. You've got some great records, 33 Test matches, almost 1,200 runs at an average, pushing 27. Again, the ODI scene, over 95 wickets. Again, a very competitive average there. So it's a wonderful kind of array of stats there, Chris. In yourself, do you consider yourself primarily a bowler who can hold a bat reasonably well, or do you put yourself in the all-rounder category?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? I class myself as an all-rounder because I believe I'm a better batsman than just a guy who can get a few runs. But, you know, in terms of a lot of the time nowadays, all-rounders are judged on their batting prowess first, which in my case is obviously different. You know, I still certainly see myself primarily as a bowler, because that's probably my number one skill and my dominant skill. But then I feel my batting's better than just a guy who can get a few runs. So, you know, I class myself as an all-rounder, but, you know, others may disagree. But for me, it doesn't really matter what I'm labelled. You know, my batting is something which I've worked extremely hard at, you know, from a young age, I suppose, particularly during my professional career. And I've always tried to get the best out of my ability with the bat. You know, I've never seen myself as you touched on, that guy that could just chip in with a few down the order. I like to really, you know, commit myself to practicing like a batsman and having that batsman mindset, which I hope helps.
Well, tell you an interesting one, which I'm sure you're aware of. Those who may want to quibble whether you yourself classify yourself as an all-rounder, as you rightly say, you're just a great player and you do your very best, always wearing your heart on your sleeve. But you've got a little slice of cricketing history in the ODI scene. I think your 95 not out against Sri Lanka, a team you seem to excel against, is the highest score in ODI history for a batsman coming in at number 8 or lower. So, you know, again, the facts don't lie, Chris. That's a, you know, that's something that holds water.
Yeah, no, I suppose it's a nice little record to have, isn't it? It's, you know, to have gone on and scored a good score. I think the most pleasing thing about that, not particularly that 95 night at Trent Bridge, was we were in a really tricky position as a team, and to be honest, looked like we were going to lose the game. And then myself and Joss put on a great partnership and you know, we ended up tying that game with the last ball six from Liam Plunkett. And, you know, I remember being out there at the end and just, you know, obviously felt like a win because we were dead and buried almost. So that really was a pleasing knock of mine, really. One of my favourite moments on a cricket field, which is, you know, it's hard to believe, really, because we didn't win the game. But, you know, it felt like I really contributed to the team getting a tie when we were completely dead and buried. So that was a nice achievement.
Again, is there a little slither of cricketing history? You've been associated with cricketing greats your whole career. A Warwickshire legend and one of the finest fast bowlers I've ever seen in Alan Donald, as a youngster, identified you, Chris, as a man who will be an England international. Just talk to me about a little bit of the pressures of expectation when you get that kind of praise and targeting almost from a young age in your early career.
Yeah, I don't know. I never looked at that as pressure, really. I saw it as more of an opportunity. You know, I saw, you know, AD was a great coach of mine, and, you know, really pleased that I managed to spend some time with him at Warwickshire in my younger years. And to hear him say something like that, it just reminded me that I obviously had something relatively special, and I obviously had a talent that I could hopefully, you know, see out to its maximum. But you know, I never saw it as added pressure, really. You know, it wasn't going to change the way I tried to play. Mm-hmm. I always tried to, as I've said before, always try and do my best and try and make the most of my ability. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't always work out, does it? But, you know, I've certainly tried to make the best of my ability and still have, really. You know, even at the age of 31, when AD said that, I was probably only, you know, 18, 19, probably. So, you know, not much has changed, really.
And that's a wonderful attitude to keep fresh and keep enjoying it. I guess it is the love of what you do that keeps you driving things forwards. One thing that really fascinates me about cricket, I think it's got a really good working relationship between the England Lions and then into the England kind of full 11 and all forms of the game. You had some great successes in that Lions culture, getting some mega scalps, the likes of Sarwan, Chander Paul, Ricky Ponting, who's not too shabby at wielding the willow. Just describe to me your experiences and this important relationship between the England Lions and then progression into the full culture of England across all the forms of the game.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think we're quite lucky, actually, with the England system. I think it's a very good system, which has obviously worked wonders for myself. And certainly gone through the gears, I suppose. That's the best way to put it. You know, started as a young lad coming through the system, you know, Warwickshire Academy player, then found myself playing some England youth age group stuff, you know, which by no means means you're going to go on and play professional and international cricket. But, you know, there's quite a few that have come through that system as well. You know, go on to then play under 19s and then into the England Lions and, you know, finally getting your full honours, which is obviously an amazing achievement. But, yeah, I think the system, you know, certainly worked. You know, in my case, I think it just developed me at the right stages of my career, you know, helped me move forwards. I always felt like there was a target, you know, always wanted to get into that next team. Once I became a professional cricketer, you know, my sole aim was just to do as good as I could for Warwickshire. And then, you know, once that started to go well, you wanted to be picked by the Lions and then you wanted to produce the goods on that sort of platform as well. And I think it just prepares you in the right manner, really. Don't get me wrong, you get the occasional player which stands out and kind of jumps the system and is fast-tracked, which, you know, happens very, very rarely. But mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, the ones that stand out are probably likes of Alistair Cook and, you know, those guys are thrown into international cricket at an early age and succeed. I believe that, you know, the route that I took kind of gave me a good grounding and a good knowledge of the game before then thrusting into international cricket.
I really think it's a wonderful quality of the culture of England and the way they things develop as a general rule. You mentioned that Alistair Cook, obviously an all-time great, and you played under him as a captain of England. You've also experienced great captains at the moment, of course, Root in the Test arena, Owen Morgan will touch on your wonderful ODI successes very, very soon. For me, one of the beautiful qualities about cricket is that a captain really matters. I know there's a lot of brouhaha about who's England captain in football. And I know that obviously they can inspire and all that kind of stuff. And we all remember David Beckham against Greece back in the day. Yeah. But really, in cricket, it's absolutely fundamental. Talk to me about the pressures of captaincy and I guess the need to keep to strategy, but then finding that balance when it's not quite working. And again, of those array of greats you've been under who've captained you, who have you learned from the most, and who would you say, if it's possible, is the best captain you've experienced?
Yeah, it's a job that I just certainly don't envy. You know, it's a tough job, as you touched on there. I think more so than any other sport, or more so than some sports in particular. You know, the cricket, in particular in cricket, you find the captain has a huge role. You know, he's constantly got a lot of pressures on him. He is certainly the guy that people look up to perform and stand up when it's really needed. And let's face it, cricket's very much an individual game, you know, or sorry, a team game played by individuals. You know, it certainly is an individual performance which matters most. And, you know, your job is defined by numbers as well, which people can see in black and white. So, you know, you're constantly scrutinised, and as a captain, even more so, you know, with wins and losses, you can perform brilliantly as a player. But, you know, if the team doesn't win, it falls on your shoulders, which is tough to take when you're probably doing your job well. So it's a job which I certainly don't envy. It's one that I find hard to do myself. There's a lot of things that go on and off the field as a captain. You know, you're involved in a hell of a lot of off-field duties as well, not alone along the media, you know, extra team meetings, selection. There's a hell of a lot that goes into it, which a lot of people don't see. So yeah, I think captains do a great job up and down the country, really, when it comes to cricket. But I think the best that I've played under, and I mean, it's probably an easy one to say Owen Morgan, but he is in my aspect. And I know it's different being a test captain to a one-day captain. You know, it's a completely different format and a lot more different pressures involved with being a test captain. But I think Morgs has just got this nature about him, which is pretty ice cool. And you know, you can see that as a spectator or as a fan. You know, he just seems to have this kind of aura about him, which he keeps things extremely calm. And as a bowler in particular, myself, you know, I've certainly learned from him in that aspect. You know, keeping calm under pressure is something which all sportsmen try and execute and try and deliver. And it's not an easy thing to do. And he's very good at that. And he's also, he kind of passes that on to his players, you know, without really forcing it down people's throats. And that's a, you know, extremely good skill to have and a good trait to have. So I'd certainly say Morgs, you know, he's great for me in terms of keeping me calm on the field. And I know a lot of the other bowlers will say the same about him.
I'll tell you what a really good call to keep him as captain, because of course after 2015 it could have gone another way and who knows what might have happened. Just coming back to that, I'm fascinated by culture and particularly as it applies to sport. Just talk to me briefly about the instrumental role that Strauss played in this wonderful ODI victory last summer, when, of course, after that ignominious World Cup, England flopped out, and can't think of a better phrase, in the group stages. Strauss was almost a mission statement-like. We need to be like Australia of the 90s, early 2000s. We need to change our mindset. We can't just apply the same technique to test and shorter forms of the game. And it did become a very clear focus. And I just love it, A-team style, when a plan comes together. And obviously, a great victory. So just remind me, or just your impressions and what you yourself experienced from Strauss instilling that culture from on high. And then as it's learnt, applied, of course, by the captain, Morgan, and then, of course, the players themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it takes some real guts, I suppose, to make that first call, which obviously Strauss did. You know, I played under Straussy, or Sir Andrew Strauss, should I say. Yeah, I played under him at I'm just trying to think when it was. It was, well, my ODI debut was under Straussy. So, and even back then, you know, he's like Morgs. He's got an aura about him when he speaks. You know, you listen. You know, he doesn't say things for the sake of it. When he says things, he means it. And obviously, he's a leader of men. And I think he made a great decision, obviously, and some big decisions in those early days when he took over that role and kind of had a clear vision with Owen, I suppose, as captain, to what he wanted that side to look like in 4 years' time at the next World Cup. And like you say, the plan come together perfectly, I suppose. But that original call to be able to say, look, this is what we need to do. This is how we need to play our cricket. This is the culture we need to bring in. This is how the mindset we need to have when we're playing white ball cricket for England. And I think that having that complete and utter change, which I don't think England cricket had in terms of, you know, Test cricket had always been the pinnacle for England cricket. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it certainly probably still is. But, you know, white ball cricket and ODI cricket in particular certainly had a little bit more, I suppose, more of a meaning in terms of it was still a real priority of them to do well in that form rather than it be an afterthought. And I think having that initial, I suppose, decision making by someone so high up in the game of Strauss-y was instrumental into the way it all unfolded for 4 years later on.
Absolutely. Brilliantly put. I appreciate your insights there. Again, we spoke about Prussia a bit earlier on from a personal perspective. And again, the culmination of this master plan, and I'm going to delve into it now. But talk to me a little bit about the weight of expectation. Because, of course, coming into that glorious tournament on home turf, England had reached not the pinnacle, which, of course, was to bring home the bacon, but at least the top-ranked ODI team. So again, there's that expectation, and then the crowd in front of you, and then it wasn't an easy road to the final. I think losing three games in the round robin stages, the media were on your case. So just talk to me a little bit about that weight of expectation and the pressure that I guess built.
Yeah, it did, and I think the beauty of it was that we knew, and this was Owen and Trevor Bayliss. Obviously, Trevor Bayliss was instrumental in the whole thing as well. You know, he had a huge impact on the white ball team in particular when he took over along with Owen as captain. And they were always on the same page. You know, we were always working towards the same goal. He wanted us to play in a certain way. And Owen obviously led that on the field with the team. But I think the big thing was we all wanted to deliver our best. But I think when Owen, at the start of the tournament and pre-tournament, kind of we had a meeting and we had a chat, and you know, it was one of those chats where like we are going to be favourites, we are going to be picked as favourites, we are going to be spoken up, we are number one in the world. You know, we don't have to play that down as a team. We don't have to go out there and be English and say, you know, oh yeah, we are number one in the world, but you know, there's a long way to go and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. That'd be the typical English answer, you know. But I think Morgs and Trevor were kind of keen for us to go out there and kind of not be arrogant, but have some sort of form of confidence to say, well, you know, we've beaten everyone in the world, we've beaten them home and away, we are number one in the world, and we've got a great chance of winning this tournament. You know, that doesn't put extra pressure on you at all. It just means that you go out there and you are favourites. Let's go out there and play like favourites. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the message from the management, and you know, the team bought into it. And of course, there was a few blips along the way. We prepared for that though, I think, as a team. We knew that we weren't going to probably go in and win 11 out of 11 and lift the trophy. We knew it was going to be as straightforward as that. You know, so I think the big turnaround for us was obviously after losing the two towards the back end of the tournament, to then go and beat India, New Zealand, mm-hmm. Australia, and then New Zealand again, who were effectively the three best teams in the tournament apart from ourselves. I think that was obviously a huge moment for us, but we knew we could do it. We'd been there and beat them before, so we knew we could go out there and deliver our skill.
Just love that, because again, the media were on your case. It was sort of a little bit like you obviously had to win out. That's the stuff that you can control up to a degree. But then there was the need for other things to fall in your favour. And my goodness me, it did. But just coming before we discuss that marvellously dramatic piece of sporting theatre, which was the final itself, one of the most astonishing elements or illustrations of sport across any sport, I would argue all time. But before we build to that, Chris, I'm fascinated to get your personal recollection of that semi-final in which you were man of the match, a three-wicket haul against the old enemy, Australia. Because, of course, you don't win that one. There's no final and no great glory. So remind us of your personal memories of that man of the match performance.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible day in my cricket career. It really was. And one that stands out hugely for me is probably, I mean, it's obviously hard to beat the World Cup final. You know, lifting that trophy at Lord's on that day was ridiculous. But, you know, prior to that, I genuinely didn't think that day at Edgbaston, probably a few days before, could be beaten, really. You know, for me to be playing a semi-final of a World Cup at home, at Edgbaston, in front of my, you know, home fans, you know, family there, you know, sort of the ground which I watched so much cricket as a kid growing up. And
I just think 81 beefy Ashes as soon as I hear Edgbaston.
Yeah. But just, yeah, it's the place which I just wanted to play cricket. I just wanted to be able to play at Edgbaston once, let alone play a World Cup semi-final there. So, yeah, it's hard to put into words, but it was, you know, it was spine tingling, I suppose, is the best way to put it. You know, the roars and the crowd when we were on top early doors in that morning when we bowled really well, particularly myself and Joffa with the new ball. It was up there with, you know, with my favourite moments on a cricket field. But, you know, a really special day for me to be obviously man of the match. But I think the bigger thing for me was the fact that how we beat Australia that day just gave us so much confidence going into the final. You know, to beat a good side like Australia in such a big game, huge pressure, just gave us great confidence going into the final.
It feels almost like a Sly Stallone movie, this one, doesn't it, sometimes? But then, just when you think it couldn't get any better, what a dramatic final. I mean, my mind is still staggered by this. It's 2-4-1, 2-4-1, it's level. There's that epic efforts from Stokesy and the whole team. Again, you get another three for yourself, Mr. Wokes, but then into a super over. And then then it's not finished. It's still dead level between you two great nations going at it in the final at Lord's. My word, what a day. Again, for me, what I'm so excited about, Chris, is that obviously we're going to build up in a minute to the upcoming West Indies series, but there's no cricket at the moment. But back then, right then, if you'd asked anybody on the street, maybe never watched cricket before, they were watching then. You captured the zeitgeist. You united the nation. Remind us again of that final and just your recollection of this theatre, because it was theatre at the highest level.
Yeah, it was, and I think it's the best way to describe it. I still sit here nearly a year on struggling to describe it and put it into words. I've tried and looked at it so many times and thought, how's the best way to describe this? But it's just utter ridiculous. I mean, for a game to end like that, I mean, in any circumstances is beyond ridiculous. But for it to be in a World Cup final, a home World Cup final, at Lord's, at HQ. I don't know, it's just like it was meant to happen for the game of cricket, for us as an England team, for everyone watching, for you know, for the fact that it was on free-to-air television was fantastic. It meant that those people that don't usually watch the game had an opportunity to watch the game. And, you know, and what a way to promote the game of cricket to the whole world, and in particular the nation, because, you know, we want to get people playing and watching as much cricket in England as possible. And that was just an incredible day for the game, you know, not for us just as a team, but for the nation, and for the game of cricket in England, it was, or in the UK particularly, it was just huge. And, you know, thankfully it went our way. Yep. Obviously it was two ties, and, you know, we're going to get ribbed about that for the rest of our lives, but at the end of the day, the rules are rules, and you know, thankfully we came out on the right side of it.
I mean, there was that slight element of controversy, wasn't there? But when the people actually looked at it in the hard light of day, oh, no, there's no issues here at all, frankly. It's all done, dusted. Yeah. Thank you very much. But it's done now. It's history. But nevertheless, for all of time, Chris Wokes, you have a World Cup winner's medal. Just out of interest, where does that live? Have you got that in a special place in your house? Or?
This is probably the only room in my house which is kind of suggests that I'm a cricketer, which is kind of my office or the study. I do keep my World Cup medal in here. So at the minute, it's in here. Maybe I should get a safe and put it in a safe just in case. But no, it's something which obviously is a prized possession. And like you say, I mean, even if I was to lose the medal, say, for instance, you know, no one can take that away from you. You're a World Cup winner. That's it. No one can take that away from you. You know, that team or that squad of players
It's a fairly select club, isn't it? To the you can
that's
your
it.
Head yeah, it amongst.
Is. Especially as an Englishman.
Indeed. We'll talk about that in just a second, actually. Just moving forwards, though, now, because obviously there's no cricket at the moment. I'm hoping it's coming back from a county side a bit later in the summer. But there is coming up a test series against West Indies, 8th of July, in these wonderful arenas, which are incredibly almost bespoke in their way that they can deal with the global situation. Again, you're in the squad, you're in contention. How exciting is this to get cricket back on again in a test arena? But how surreal will it be to go from that moment we've discussed in front of a raucous, passionate home support to empty arena cricket?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be different, isn't it? Of course it is. And, you know, as an international cricketer, you get used to, particularly in England, you know, we're very lucky. We get full crowds, you know, full stadiums and great atmospheres. And we're very fortunate for that. But, you know, it's just a weird situation we're all in at the moment, isn't it? It's very strange. You know, the new normal that keeps getting branded around is just very, very different to what we're all used to. So, you know, we're going to have to get used to it. You know, at the end of the day, it's still a game, still a bat versus the ball. Yes, there's going to be no atmosphere on the ground, but it's great for the game. You know, it's really important for the game as well that we get some cricket, in particular international cricket. You know, the ECB and the counties will certainly benefit, obviously, from us playing international cricket. And we've all seen the numbers that, you know, have been shouted about that if, you know, we wasn't playing any cricket, it would have an astronomical effect on the game. So, of course, it's going to be strange. And, you know, like you said, touching on what happened last summer, you know, in comparison to what we're going to be going through this summer, it's a world apart. But we have no choice. And, you know, it's we've got an important role to try and bring cricket back to the people, which is obviously, you know, exciting as well.
Brilliant stuff, and you do it so well. And again, it, for me, that summer, I'm sure the whole of the UK was just united in passion, in enthrallment. And I just think it's so important for the wonderful game of cricket that we do keep that momentum building and keep that interest level. Because, of course, it's out of that that seven-year-olds will be maybe inspired to become perhaps the next Wokes, the next Stokes, or whoever it might be. So that's so, so critical. Chris, I've really valued your time. I've got one final question for you as a World Cup winner. Last week's Verum Sport podcast, we were analysing tech in sport and we were talking about goal line technology. Of course, we had to. And there was recollections of that Lampard effort ruled out in the Germany World Cup that kind of obviously had a psychological element to it. And I respect that. But I made a very strong point. I take a hard line stance to this. I personally think it's absolutely abject that England football hasn't won anything in international football since, of course, that glorious day back in the home turf of 66. In that time, of course, you guys have been 2020 Kings of the World, ODI champs, as we have analysed. The Rugby World Cup boys have done the business at least once. The athletics team GB keeps on going from strength to strength in consecutive Olympics. And if you think of resource and management, and of course, ultimately, sheer brute numbers, football will always be the preeminent sport from a fan perspective, I think it's abject. I think there are serious questions, and I would love your take as a man who understands processes. Why on earth is it, given all of that resource, that England haven't even so much as got a European championship since 66?
Yeah, it's, obviously, I wish I had the answer. I wish I had the exact answer. We could all lift a World Cup. It would be amazing for the nation. Obviously, not that long ago, we got close, but not quite close enough. And I think that's been our best, you know, one opportunity, but also two, our best performance for a long time. You know, I look at the team now and I feel like the system is working. We, you know, we've got a great team. You know, you can clearly see us playing in a different manner to England teams have done in the past. But to answer the question bluntly, I suppose, is, you look at, you know, some of the teams we've had over the years, you know, the Beckhams, the Nevilles, the Gerrards, the Lampards, some the Owens, you know, some great players and some great teams, and unfortunately just haven't been able to do it. And, you know, I haven't got the sole reason why that is, but I think if you look across the board, a lot of pressure is put on our footballers, isn't it? You know, we certainly built them up to to make sure we bring them right down to the bottom as well. Mm. So, you know, this, you know, as a professional cricketer and who's certainly been put under pressure at certain times during my career, you know, it does have an effect. There's no doubt about that. You know, they're human beings. You know, they're out there playing football, and of course they play the hell of a lot of money. But mm-hmm. you know, still sometimes, you know, pressure does take its toll. But I also believe a big problem in professional football is that the clubs rule the roost.
Yeah.
And playing for England a lot of the time comes second, which, well, basically in any other sport, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. You know, playing for your country is the number one. And just unfortunately, that's probably not the case in football. Well, not for every player anyway. Don't get me wrong. I know some players are extremely passionate and want to play for the country and, you know, certainly want to do the best for England. But I just think that clubs do rule the roost, and sometimes players are kind of loyal to their clubs a lot of the time, which is, you know, everyone's got to earn a living regardless of how much money you earn. I think that does play a huge part in how England play their football and how it has done in the past anyway. I think we're moving in the right direction. Some really exciting players. Playing for England obviously does mean a lot to a lot of players.
Yeah, I think they've got it right with a DNA program, which is almost inspired by something like a Strauss mentality. So we'll see if that transpires to some type of success in the near future. But you, Chris Wokes, are a man who oozes success, a World Cup winner in your own right. It has been an honour and a privilege to enjoy some time in your company. Thank you very much indeed for your time today.
No worries, mate. Thanks for having me on. I hope everyone's enjoyed listening. Cheers, pal.